Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Paul Lakeland, the inaugural Aloysius P. Kelly S.J. Professor of Catholic Studies and founding director of the Center for Catholic Studies at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. He'll speak on the topic, A Short Voyage for a God, the Grace of Creative Writing. Professor Lakeland's remarks were given as the 16th annual Michael G. Lawler Lecture in Catholic Theology, presented annually by Creighton University and sponsored by the Center for Catholic Thought at Creighton. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 26, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is John O'Keefe, Professor of Theology and Director of the Center for Catholic Thought at Creighton University.
In 2004, Lakeland was named the inaugural Aloysius P. Kelly S.J. Professor of Catholic Studies, and he is the founding director of the Center for Catholic Studies at Fairfield. He has taught at Fairfield since 1981, serving as the department chair in religious studies for 10 years and 6 years as the director of the honors program. He teaches courses in liberation theology, Catholic ecclesiology, and religion and literature. And for the past 5 years, he has also served as visiting faculty at Yale Divinity School. Paul Lakeland holds a licentiate in philosophy from the Heathrow Pontifical Athenaeum, an MA in English language and literature from Oxford University, a Bachelor of Divinity degree from Heathrow College in the University of London, and his PhD in 1981 is from Vanderbilt University. He's the author of 9 books, the latest of which is called A Council That Will Never End, Lumen Gentium and the Church Today, published in 2013. His 2003 book, The Liberation of the Laity in Search of an Accountable Church, received the Catholic Press Association Award for Best Book in Theology in 2004. Lakeland is a member of the American Academy of Religion, the American Theological Society, and the Catholic Theological Society of America. His research interests include Roman Catholic ecclesiology and the relationship between Jesuit spirituality and higher education. He is currently at work on a book provisionally entitled Wrestling with Ignatius, Reflections on Jesuit Education. In a brief bio that was sent to me in advance, I am told that Lakeland blogs occasionally and reviews Fiction for Commonweal, a Catholic journal of opinion. He is married to Beth Palmer and has one son, Jonathan. Both of them are professional classical pianists. He, however, has absolutely no musical skills. And when he is not being a theologian or a literary critic, he likes to cook, play table tennis, and he goes to the gym regularly, but says he does not like that as much. Please join me in welcoming Professor Lakeland as he speaks to us on the topic, A Short Voyage to God, the Grace of Creative Writing.
Thank you all very much. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. It's a rarity to be asked to give a lecture named in honor of some distinguished figure and then to see him sitting on the front row listening. Fortunately for me, I chose to talk about something that is very different from what I usually talk about and from what he would be probably know more about than I do. So I'm very happy to see him here. I'm delighted to have been offered the opportunity to do this, and I'm just setting things up so I can actually see my text. Can you hear me okay? Yep. Okay, good. So as John said, we're going to talk about the grace of creative writing, and you have a blue sheet with a poem on it, which we will get to shortly, very shortly, actually. So, for quite a number of years now, as I have taught countless undergraduates in courses in religious studies, I found myself moving away from assigning theological texts to to requiring that they read more and more examples of creative writing. Some poetry, certainly, but mostly novels and shorter fiction. I expect some of you have followed a similar path or encountered professors who do. I have a number of ways to explain this to myself. There is no question, in the first place, that the averagely written piece of fiction is likely to be a more attractive piece of writing than even the best examples of theological writing. Second, if you choose carefully, the work of fiction may bring before the students exactly the point or issue that you want them to be considering. I have, for example, often found myself turning to Graham Greene's The End of the Affair to illustrate the power of sacrament and the modern fascination with miracle. And a story like André Debout's A Father's Tale brings students to a stark confrontation with the idea that love for his children can make a very good man do a bad thing. Third, it may just be that I am a frustrated English professor who is more attracted to literature than theology. After all, I was an English major in college. One of my little bios, one that I did not give to John, admits that I read fiction to escape theology. And as the years go by, I certainly read more of the former and less of the latter. My favorite courses to teach these days are two: Saints and Sinners, Images of Holiness in Modern Fiction, and Belief and Unbelief, Explorations of the Space Between, both of which are primarily devoted to works of fiction. Now, as I reflect on this turn in my teaching, it seems to me that all this is a bit easy and might need to be explored more deeply. Of course, one can use works of fiction, or nonfiction for that matter, to help students appropriate ideas, experience emotions, and so on. But this is simply to use literature as we might pull an image off the web or slip in a quick video from YouTube. We're grabbing the content to make a point. And I am pretty sure my college tutor all those years ago would accuse me from her bookish corner of heaven of just using the works of the imagination, squeezing the ideas out of them and ignoring the creative work itself. Throwing her Siamese cat aside, she would sit bolt upright in her armchair as she did practically every week for 3 years, point her finger at me, and pronounce with charming brutality that interrogative opening she strongly favored and I feared as much. "Yes, but what do you mean by," in this case, using literature to make a point? So in my talk this evening, I do not plan to tell you about all the books I use and what lessons I draw from them for students, though I will continue to do that in my classes and to find it, on the whole, a more productive way to introduce undergraduates to more abstruse theological ideas. I want instead to explore a little bit what I suppose one has to call a theology of literature. In other words, how and when is reading literature a religious act, even if the chosen works are distinctly secular? When we enter into a relationship with a literary work, what is happening, religiously speaking? Is it indeed revelatory? And if so, how? Now, I hope I do not need to add here that I am not suggesting either that the author has a consciously religious objective, or indeed that the reader does. In fact, my expectation is that either or both is engaged with the work solely as an artistic creation. So I'm going to proceed in the customary three parts. First, I'm going to gain a bit of traction through a close reading of Mary Carr's poem, Descending Theology, Christ Human, which is what you have on your blue sheet there, the first words of which provide the title for this lecture, and which will, I believe, suggest some responses to what we are engaged in when we read. Second, I will turn to Wendy Lesser's notion of the space between, a term I arrived at quite independently for the subtitle of the course I mentioned a few moments ago, to see if this idea can help us to understand something about the where, the location of revelatory reading. And then in a third and final section, I'll offer a few reflections on the theological status of the work of literature, focusing particularly on three well-worn words in the theological lexicon: grace, love, and gift. I hope you will consider this worthwhile. Those of you who are keen readers will, if my thoughts carry any weight, walk a little taller tonight. Now, those who are not so bookish may be inspired to become a little more so. So, first, part one. So now let's go to our blue sheet. And I'm going to read a piece of the poem. I've broken it into about four pieces. I'm going to read a piece and then comment on it. So here we go. Such a short voyage for a god. And you arrived in animal form so as not to scorch us with your glory. Your mask was an infant's head on a limp stalk, sticky eyes smeared blind, limbs rendered useless in swaddle. How can God appear in human history? Only, it would seem, somehow veiled in order that we not be scorched by the divine presence. So our author here, Mary Carr, sees God becoming incarnate in all the vulnerability of a baby unable to hold up its head and not yet seeing clearly, restrained and restricted by the choice of entering into the worldly condition. But there are two other thoughts that might arise from these first few lines, two questions to put to the poet and ourselves. What does Carr mean by declaring it a short voyage from the celestial to the worldly? And why does she say animal form when we might expect and even prefer human form? She seems to imply, on the one hand, that the distinction between a god and the world is no vast distance, not at all the usual theological standoff between the transcendent and the immanent. To enter into immanence is no big deal, just a short voyage. And on the other hand, she wants to arrest our eyes at animal and recognize that while God has no trouble entering into the world, we human beings need to accept that we are indeed animals, that it is the animal that God adopts in the incarnation, and that when God takes up our humanity, God is entering into the animal condition. Okay, next chunk of the poem. You came among beasts as one, came into our care or its lack, came crying as we all do, because the human frame is a crucifix, each skeleton born a lifetime. Any wanting soul lain prostrate on a floor to receive the poured sunlight might, if still enough, feel your cross buried in the flesh. Now, these few lines begin by reinforcing the incarnation as an animal, you came among beasts as one, and adding that in so doing, God accepts dependence upon a most unreliable source of care. But the important idea here is the image of the human frame as a skeleton. Now it is no longer the brute or animal, but the human being who is under scrutiny. And it is the human frame, the skeleton, which is a crucifix. Our distinctness from other animals is what we might call our cruciform nature, that we are shaped as and shaped by the cross. Aware of our share of sin and suffering in the world, even and especially in a calm moment, lying in the sunshine, far from the pain of the world. Next piece. One has only to surrender, you preached. Open both arms to the inner, the ever-present embrace which props one up, outreaches every grasp. It's in the form embedded, love adamant as bone. When we accept our crucified condition, Carr seems to be saying, when we show our acceptance by opening our arms, adopting the shape of the cross, then we are embraced by a love which supports and exceeds us. But what about the love adamant as bone being in the form embedded? Well, we noticed, didn't we, that the embrace is inner and ever-present. Our nature is always already graced. The loving embrace of God is always already within us, as much a part of us as our bone, our skeleton. Just as our cruciform nature is not simply one of pain, but also, since it is Christ-like, formed in obedience to a larger and more generous set of impulses. Last piece of the poem. The miracle's not just that you became us, but also those breathed-in instants allotted to us each, even poor brother Judas, when one relinquishes self and will and want. Then you're laid bare in us, and for some briefly gentle eye blink, we bloom and are you. And so the poet concludes, the miracle is not simply the incarnation of God in the world, but that when we become cruciform, when, like Christ, we relinquish self and will and want, then for a moment we become Christ. When that happens, however, it is not something added on so much as the manifestation of our essential nature. When Christ is laid bare in us, then we bloom. It is our nature that expands in becoming Christ. It is not contradicted or transcended. It would be a very challenging proposition to maintain that this poem actually represents the ideas of incarnation, sin, and redemption more clearly than might a particularly good textbook of Christian theology, if indeed any such exists. Nor is there much in the way of religious experience in the exercise we have just completed. Analyzing a poem is a bit like explaining a joke. But if there is any merit in the process we just went through, it shows up when we reread the poem. Rereading, by the way, a practice foreign to almost all students, excepting, of course, those in this room. Rereading a practice foreign to almost all students and perhaps to many teachers is absolutely essential, immeasurably more important than mere analysis. The great novelist Vladimir Nabokov so famously wrote, and I quote, "Curiously enough, one cannot read a book. One can only reread it. A good reader, a major reader, an active and creative reader is a rereader." So what he meant was, the first read, you're just getting ready. The second read, you begin to understand. The advantage of a good analysis is that it sensitizes us and deepens our potential levels of awareness. We might say, more colloquially, that it softens us up. But for what? Not, I think, for deeper theological insights, but rather for entry into the mystery of the creative work itself. The poet and the novelist, in their different ways, invite us into a world. They are, on the whole, not interested in making a point or teaching a lesson. If this were their principal aim, I would venture to say, then their work is not creative writing. Now, I very deliberately chose as my starting point a religious poem because it is easier to make the connections. But there's no particular reason why an explicitly religious poem should itself be more revelatory of the sacred than a defiantly secular creation. The key is that neither is didactic or apologetic. I think this is pretty much what Flannery O'Connor was thinking when she wrote, and I quote, "The Catholic novelist doesn't have to be a saint. He doesn't even have to be a Catholic. He does, unfortunately, have to be a novelist." It's also hidden behind the old piece of advice handed out on the first day of every creative writing course, "Don't tell, show." I want to go a step further myself and, borrowing a little cadence from the philosopher Martin Heidegger, say, "Don't tell or show. Rather, open up a clearing in which something can appear." The great critic George Steiner, in one of his best books called Real Presences, argues that the work of art is not opened up by criticism, or we might say, or by analysis, but by its performance, if music or drama, or its recitation, if poetry, or perhaps even prose. Indeed, he says, all serious art, music, and literature is a critical act. And then he goes on, "The construct of the artist is a counterstatement to the world. Aesthetic means embody concentrated, selective interactions," and here's the phrase you want to remember, "between the constraints of the observed and the boundless possibilities of the imagined." Perhaps this is the way to include the novel. For although the reader does not actually perform the work and rarely recites it from memory, it is always this person's reading or that, where the text itself, what Steiner calls the constraints of the observed, comes into contact with the subjectivity of the reader and the boundless possibilities of the imagined. So to close out this first section then, the what of a theology of literature is the work that opens up a space in which the human imagination is invited to consider all that matters in and gives shape to her or his world. In this space, whether we believe it or not, we encounter the love of God that is identical to the Christ in our own embodied selves, love adamant as bone. Moreover, we do not encounter it as an object to be identified or admired. We encounter it in practice and contemplation. Insofar as we discover meaning and beauty and truth in the space that the work of art opens up for us, to that degree, we are in a holy space. As Simone Weil wrote in her book Gravity and Grace, "In everything which gives us the pure, authentic feeling of beauty, there is really the presence of God." Hence, she added, "All art of the highest order is religious in essence." Part 2. One of the courses I have lately most enjoyed teaching, I mentioned it a few minutes ago, is something I call Belief and Unbelief: Explorations of the Space Between. The point of the title is the fairly obvious one, that what is interesting from a theological perspective when you think about belief and unbelief is neither the text in which faith shines out pure, simple, and unchallenged, nor the crass rejection of anything not measurable by the scientific method. So we're not interested in texts that have nothing but absolute certainty about belief, and not interested in texts that will not even countenance the possibility of belief. All interesting discussions of belief and unbelief occur in that vast region of ambiguity inhabited by most believers and most secularists, where the yearning for transcendence meets the apparently meaningless suffering of the innocent. So the texts I use to explore these issues with students are stories like Miguel de Unamuno's Saint Emmanuel the Martyr, or Graham Greene's A Burnt-Out Case, and the poetry of Emily Dickinson and Wallace Stevens. But once again, I have to confess, I largely use them in order to extract insights about the tensions of faith and its loss or lack. In other words, in a manner somewhat blind to or inconsiderate of what their authors set out to do as creative artists. I recently read a new book by Wendy Lesser, the author, critic, and founding editor of the world-famous Threepenny Review. The book's called Why I Read: The Serious Pleasure of Books. And it contains a chapter called The Space Between, but it is discussed in a way that is measurably more sophisticated than my own use of the idea, and which will take us a step further in our foray into the theology of literature. For Lesser, there are many kinds of gaps left by the authors in their texts, sometimes intentionally, sometimes accidentally, and sometimes forced upon them by narrow-minded editors. The best illustrations in Lesser's discussion occur in poetry, where she writes, and I'm quoting Wendy Lesser here, "The kind of connection that is usually essential to our understanding of what is happening has been purposely removed." In poetry, I repeat, "The kind of connection that is usually essential to our understanding of what is happening has been purposely removed." Many, you will have noticed it, many of you, when you read a poem and you sit back and you think, well, I understand all the words, but I don't know what it means. That's what's going on there. So we are drawn by the mysterious and enigmatic character of poetry into a space left open for us to search out what it is so important for the poet to say. The space between that interests us then is the space between the reader and the writer, the place and time where the creativity of the author and the imagination of the reader conspire together to illuminate the enigmas of human life. When the reader enters this space, he or she is claimed by the text. Poetry or prose, the text is a sacred space in which the reader learns something about the workings of grace in her or his soul. The reader who enters into the imaginative space opened up by the creative artist is not necessarily a believer. Perhaps we could adjust Flannery O'Connor's remark I quoted a few minutes ago to say that the reader does not need to be religious, but alas, does need to be a reader. When we attend carefully, surely at least some of the time, we will have to respond to Christian Wiman's question in his new great book, My Bright Abyss, Meditation of a Modern Believer. This is the question he asks of people who say, I don't have a religious bone in my body. Have you never felt overwhelmed by and in some way inadequate to an experience in your life? Have you never felt something in yourself staking a claim beyond yourself? some wordless mystery straining through the words to reach you? This is a question for any human being, even if the Christian thinker will interpret it as the action of grace. But Wyman has a warning even for the Christian. Religion, he writes, is not made of these moments. Religion is the means of making these moments part of your life, rather than merely radical intrusions so foreign and perhaps even fearsome that you can't even acknowledge their existence afterwards. So Lesser's notion of the space between allows us language to talk about which kinds of literary texts work in this way and which do not. I am, for example, a voracious reader of detective fiction, but I am pretty sure that by far the majority of this kind of book do not possess a space between. They tell a story that is immediately available in unambiguous presence to a reader for whom the narrative is all. Done. Put it down. Get the next one. Highly skilled storytelling may be of this type, from Ian Fleming to Agatha Christie to Georges Simenon, though most detective fiction tends to be formulaic and, frankly, second-rate literature. We cannot all be Dostoevsky, of course. But serious fiction, which certainly includes some detective fiction, though probably not many thrillers or comic novels and no, quote-unquote, beach reading, is distinguished by the interpretive space that stands between the author and the reader. It is in this space that the reader is faced with the challenges of the question that the text puts to her or him. Wherever this happens, divine grace is at work. Because what the grace of God already present in the individual yearns for is fuller self-possession as a human being. The more human we are, the more graced we are. When we fall away from grace and into sinfulness, our humanity is impoverished. Now, if poetry works, as Lesser suggests, because the kind of connection that is usually essential to our understanding of what is happening has been purposely removed, we cannot assert exactly the same for prose. Some prose, of course, aspires to the condition of poetry. We might think of James Joyce in this way. But the novel or short story as a whole sets out to open up a space through a narrative in which nothing is purposely removed, but much is left, at least partially, underdeveloped. This is why we can confidently say that serious literature possesses a measure of ambiguity. We all know this, of course, that literature that doesn't raise a single issue of any import and ties up all the loose ends nicely isn't serious, though it may well be very good of its kind. Faith, hope, and love grow or wane in the more tensive space to be interpreted of serious fiction. Part 3. Where I think all this leaves us is with the wish to defend the claim that good literature can be defined as creative writing that invites us into a world or opens up a space in which, in a more contemplative than intellectual mode, we can do the work of inhabiting the countercultural space in our own unique way. A theologian, or anyone for that matter, might refer to this world or space as holy, precisely because of the human activity that it invites. Using a temporal rather than a spatial image, a theologian might call what is going on in this space when the invitation is accepted a moment of grace. Now, grace is a beautiful name for a woman, but dense and elusive as a concept for people today. mainly because it is still the case that grace as a religious idea is all too frequently represented as a substance which God makes available to us in a variety of ways. When I was in elementary school in the late Middle Ages, it was a kind of ray, inevitably golden, shot from a triangle called God somewhere in the top left-hand corner of the chalkboard in a huge arc and landing on the head of a child, equally inevitably kneeling to receive Holy Communion. I could write an entire other lecture on all that is wrong with this picture, but fortunately for you, I only have time for the present one. So let's just say that grace is the loving presence of God, and add simply that in the Catholic understanding, grace is a constitutive dimension of the human person. Sometimes people can deny or reject grace or be distractedly oblivious to its presence, but it is always there, wherever there is a human being. In the graced space or moment that reading literature opens us up to, what we learn in the end is something about the human. The boundless possibilities of the imagination laid out for us by the creative artist react in some way with our own graced nature. So grace, the loving presence of God, and its effects are tied to the growing humanization of the individual. A humanization that is also a divinization. The more human we are, the more we are in the image of God, the more godlike we are. The more we grow in the image and likeness of God, the more we grow to be who we are meant to be, which means the more and more fully human we become. I haven't put it in my text, but I cannot resist quoting the old line from St. Irenaeus at this point: the glory of God is the human being fully alive. This process is in no way linked to any particular religious perspective, since it simply follows from understanding our human nature as a direct consequence of our being created by God in the divine image. In the space between, the grace that is always already a part of us as human beings is given the opportunity to grow greater and flourish more abundantly through increase in wisdom and compassion. What we learn in the encounter with great literature may not be pleasant and may not always be profound, but it will always enrich us with the gifts of the Holy Spirit: wisdom, understanding, counsel, courage, knowledge, piety, and fear of the Lord. Thus we become simultaneously more ourselves and more Christ-like, and can be so whether we know or do not know, accept or reject the person of Christ. This is what serious literature does. And if whatever we are reading has this effect upon us, we can be confident that it is serious literature. But let me go back for a minute to the caricature of grace that I learned at the feet of the nuns in my elementary school 60 years ago. You recall the arc of yellow stuff that came down from God in the top corner onto and presumably into the head of the kneeling Christian child in the foreground of the picture. As I said then, this is about as wrong as you can be. Grace is not something you get, though it is certainly given by God. But it is given as part and parcel of our graced nature as children of God. It is within us, and it grows and flourishes insofar as we open ourselves to it, which is to say, insofar as we open ourselves to our humanity as made in the image and likeness of God. Grace is all around us. It is within us, and we are within it. To use a slightly different term, grace is gift. Everything, indeed, is gift. And as Georges Bernanos put it at the end of his wonderful novel, The Diary of a Country Priest, everything is grace. So even if we do not cooperate with it, it will be there, stunted perhaps, but there nonetheless. Nature without grace would be monstrous, or as Karl Rahner and others have said, Nature alone is a remainder concept, theoretically meaningful, but not actually existing anywhere. While the grace of God is something which lives in us and in which we live, which is as close to us as we are to ourselves, it is also true that some moments and places and people may be particularly privileged moments of grace for us. This is true whenever we are made especially aware of the love of God and the goodness of God's creation, but also when we are alerted to the vagaries of human freedom and the tragedies of personal events and encounters, even in the face of God's love. So, for example, the seven sacraments celebrated in the Catholic tradition are ritualized reminders of encounters with divine grace. When we are baptized or married or receive communion, we are recalled by the ritual to the ever-present reality of divine love in our lives. In moments of grief and negativity, we can also be made especially aware of the love of God consoling us, being compassionate or merciful. And we can sometimes have to live with the challenge of God's apparent absence. Literary works serve an analogous function to the rituals of sacrament in the Catholic tradition. Just as the sacrament is a blend of matter and form, so the work of art is a narrative fashioned in words and images. Being drawn into the story is to become a player in the world of the text, entering into dialogue with the challenges the narrative presents to us, and being in the end called to take up a position. The text makes a demand upon us, and the response we make to that demand forms us as human beings in a particular way relative to the love of God and the workings of grace. By engaging with the world of the text, we become more fully human, more aware of how love and grace work through the complexities and ambiguities of human life. Sometimes we talk about enrichment as the product of engaging with great works of art. Often that has a demeaning note to it when we contrast enrichment with for-credit learning. But I would like to suggest that enrichment is exactly what should be the consequence of an encounter with a great poem or novel. Sometimes we hear that literature of consequence helps us to see the world a little differently, and that can certainly happen and is significant if it does. But perhaps the more important change that art works upon us is in how we understand ourselves. In the encounter with the arts in general, and with the literary arts in particular, we begin and end in complete openness to the world that will be laid out before us. This is in itself, perhaps before we even turn to the first page, an act of faith. Faith in the gift character of all that is. There is no reading that is worthwhile if we do not give ourselves to the text, if we do not allow it the opening statement in the conversation that is to take place. To come to a text suspiciously or with our minds otherwise foreclosed shuts off the possibility that the act of reading may be a moment of grace. No growth will occur. Nothing will be gained. But at the same time, our openness is critical. Just because we let the text be what it is, we will soon be alerted to discordances, whether they are stylistic or substantive, if the book is poorly written or its topic vapid or negative. The reader will rightly judge that there is no opportunity here for the moment of grace in which the spirit can flourish and grow, and she will sadly close the book. While we come to the text in an attitude of critical openness, we do so as the people we already are. This is the explanation for differences in interpretation. We all read the same words on the page, but our interaction with those words, assuming the openness that reading requires, is a product of who we are as individuals as we encounter the text. At the same time, the text is not neutral, not a blank page upon which our individual selves work out meaning for us. We can differ productively about the meaning of the text, but we can never say whatever. The text invites us into a world of possibility, even of ambiguity, a field of meaning in which we play and delight. The more open we are to the text, the more vulnerable becomes our self-understanding, and with that, the more growth becomes possible, even likely. So we've spent pretty much the whole of this discussion focused on what is happening in the reception of the work of art. But what of its creation? When we turn to the artist, what we have to notice most of all is the gratuitousness of the act of creation, what George Steiner again calls a wholly unpredictable choice not to be. A wholly unpredictable choice not to be. Everything is gift, as we said a few moments ago, and the creative artist is a co-creator with God in the gift of love. Steiner is, of course, right that any individual work of art is what he calls a supremely free act. But from the perspective of Christian theology, it is also a participation in the fecundity of divine creativity. Grace, divine love, is freely offered and freely given. What is also true is that the work in the hands of the artist will have a life of its own as it is coming into existence, and any sense of sending a message or teaching a lesson is far from the artist's mind. Joseph Conrad once said that the artist has to descend within the self to a region of stress and strife where, if lucky, he or she finds the terms of his or her appeal. Writing about the Catholic novel and the challenge of writing one, Flannery O'Connor quoted Conrad favorably and added in her typically wry way, and I quote, "Where you find the terms of your appeal may have little or nothing to do with what is challenging in the life of the church at the moment." The writer, she says, has to report what she sees. For the Catholic, and I'm quoting Flannery O'Connor again, a belief in a fixed dogma cannot fix what goes on in life or blind the believer to it. And if the writer uses his eyes in the real security of his faith, he will be obliged to use them honestly, and his sense of mystery and his acceptance of it will be increased. Anyone who has read much of O'Connor's fiction, and especially her first novel, Wise Blood, can testify how well she followed her own advice. So, the author gives freely the gift of the work to the world. And the reader freely enters into the space the author has opened up, receiving the gift that is at one and the same time the gift of the work and the gift of God, the gracious enabling of infinite possibility. Quoting Steiner again, "The experiencing of created form is a meeting between freedoms." There is in this picture something of the mystery of the incarnation, since God's creativity consists in part in the gift of the Son to the world, a gift which, when freely accepted, opens the believer to the heights and depths of the saving love of God. And we should also not forget that the divine gift, like the life of Christ himself, has a paschal dimension that is shared to a degree by the creative artist. As Simone Weil wrote when analyzing the parable of the Good Samaritan in her great essay Forms of the Implicit Love of God, "The action of the Samaritan mirrors the self-emptying of Christ, while the victim, like the Christian, is raised to new life." "In denying oneself," says Weil, "one becomes capable under God of establishing someone else by a creative affirmation, and this is a redemptive act. I lose, and miraculously through losing, I gain." The exhausted artist is both depleted and nourished by the work of creation. The reader is certainly nourished, and if not exactly depleted, called somehow to a response that must involve a little death to self in the service of greater understanding. Great works of art may be comic or more likely tragic, but they are always challenging. They demand something the reader has to give. They are never just nice. I do not, in the end, know if these thoughts will lead me to a different way of bringing literature to my students in courses in religious studies or theology. Part of its use is pragmatic, to offer in more digestible form the subtleties of theological truths, but never, of course, suggesting that this is the most important thing about the work in question, still less that an artist can primarily be concerned with teaching something. Flannery O'Connor, one more time, once wrote, and I quote, "There is a moment in every great story in which the presence of grace can be felt as it waits to be accepted or rejected, even though the reader may not recognize the moment." Perhaps our task in reading literature is to be open to that possibility, and to read theologically is to be able to name that moment as gift, grace, and love. Not a bad lesson for a course in theology. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Paul Lakeland, the inaugural Aloysius P. Kelly S.J. Professor of Catholic Studies and founding director of the Center for Catholic Studies at Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut. He spoke on the topic, A Short Voyage for a God, The Grace of Creative Writing. Professor Lakeland's remarks were given as the 16th Annual Michael G. Lawler Lecture in Catholic Theology, presented annually by Creighton University and sponsored by the Center for Catholic Thought at Creighton. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, March 26, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.